point home. Our names were on the public comments list. The only question now was whether anyone would listen. Here we go, Paul said as we neared the doors to the building. If anyone can make Iola come alive for these people, you can. I looked into his eyes and was momentarily convinced that I could do anything. Paul made me feel larger than I was, invincible. He believed in me in a way that made me believe in myself. Sometime in the middle of the night, as we sat in the blue room, the soft light of the Tiffany Magnolia lamp bathing dozens of failed attempts at speech writing wadded on the floor, I looked at Paul, bent over one of Iola's prayer boxes, and realized that I didn't know what I would do without him. His was the smile I looked forward to most in the day, his and Zoe's and JT's. His was the voice that fell softly in my ear, that built me up rather than tearing me down. I'd never known anyone like Paul Chastain. I hadn't told him that, how much he meant to me. I wasn't sure why, but the words weren't there. I didn't have a definition for Paul and me. I didn't have words for what this was. Maybe he didn't either, and that was part of the problem. I wasn't sure what I was to him, a project, a way to fill a gap in his life. Part of a fractured family he felt the need to reroot and repair, rebuild like he rebuilt storm-damaged beaches? What could I possibly be to someone like him, other than a project? 2 steps inside the commissioner's court, I panicked. Completely. The room was filled to capacity, even though the meeting wasn't to begin for 20 minutes yet. People stood along the walls, sat on the floor in the center aisle. In the semicircular rows of seats, some attendees were already sitting 2 to a chair. I can't do this, I whispered and tried to hand the notebook to Paul. I wasn't sure what I'd expected, but the interior looked like a courtroom. Dark wooden walls, gallery seating filled with onlookers, a heavy U-shaped stand where the commissioners sat behind marble countertops on a raised dais. My mind rushed back to countless visits to family court, adults asking questions, making decisions, casting looks of pity our way. Suddenly I was a little girl again, powerless, afraid. I think I'm going to be sick. I tried to turn and run out the door. Paul caught me before I could escape. His arm formed a firm, strong circle around my waist. Let go, I protested loudly enough that a uniformed officer glanced my way. I lowered my voice. Just take the notebook, Paul. You know everything we were planning to say. I can't go in there. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't think. Paul's skin pressed warm against mine. Yes, you can, Tandy, you can. His gaze grabbed me, held on. You're the one who lived it. You're the one who needs to tell the story of the boxes in that house. He set the poster boards beside the wall, took my face in both of his hands, stared hard at me like a rescue diver trying to convince a shipwreck victim to stop floundering and start swimming. Come on, just like we practiced. Don't let these people intimidate you. You're stronger than that.
Paul,
I'm right here. I'm not going anywhere. He leaned close, his forehead almost touching mine, his nearness blocking out the sounds of people whispering, bodies shifting impatiently, chairs scraping the floor. For a moment, I saw only Paul, heard only his voice. When you get your turn to talk, don't think about the commissioners. Just tell me the story, like you did last night when we practiced at Iola's house. Now, remember, they'll go through all the people who signed up earlier on the agenda first, so there will be a bunch of talk about different issues. Then Geneva comes up, and then you. Geneva will prep the court with a list of complaints she's gathered about more borrow pits and a holding pond going in. And then it's you. You show them, Tandy. Show them what they're talking about destroying so that they can dig sand and drain water to save houses that have been built where they shouldn't have been in the first place. Houses that likely won't survive another storm or two. You ask those commissioners and the audience, which house has the right to be here? The ones that are sliding off into the water, or the one that has made it through every storm? You show them who Iola was and what the house meant and everything she did for the banks.
Which house has the right to be here? I heard my grandfather's voice.
What are they saying? The storms will never come? You build a house on the sand shifts eventually, Tandy Joe. You remember that?
I heard Isabel. Fear builds walls instead of bridges. I want a life of bridges, not walls.
Swallowing the pulsating lump at my chest, I pulled in air,
nodded because I couldn't find my voice, and let Paul lead me forward. Geneva, Bank, Zoe, JT, and Brother Gilbo were sitting in a row near the middle. I recognized many of the faces around them. The fishermen of Fairhope had turned out in force. Zoe and JT wiggled out of a single seat by the aisle.
"Here," JT offered, grabbing his jacket from the back of the chair. "We saved you a seat."
Zoe nodded, her face filled with tenderness and something else I'd never seen in her before, or at least not in a long time. Admiration.
"Go get 'em, Mama."
She hugged me, then pressed the mermaid's tear necklace into my palm. I closed my fingers around it and let her faith seep into me. We'd been brought here, back to these islands, for a reason. For so many reasons that I was only now beginning to see. "I will," I promised, holding the necklace as I slipped into my seat. "I will, Zoe. Don't worry." JT folded himself into the space in front of my chair, sitting on my feet, while Zoe moved to the back to stand by the wall where Sandy and the girls had staked out a corner. Paul sat beside me on the floor, holding the poster boards on his crossed legs as the meeting came to order with all the normal proceedings. Announcements, prayer, pledge of allegiance. I tried to take in air and let it out to still the trembling in my hands. I needed to appear confident when it was my turn to speak. I had to be convincing. I had to be worthy. After the court's opening program, the agenda moved on with a short ceremony, giving several county workers their 5- and 10-year service pins. In spite of the routine proceedings, the room was filled with tension and expectation, with a sense that everyone was waiting for what would come later. I closed my eyes and turned a page in my head. Imagine this moment as if it had already passed, as if I were reading it in one of Iola's prayer letters. How would she write this? What would she say? What would she ask for just before those closing words, "Your loving daughter"? Wisdom, strength, a steady voice? The presentation of the pins concluded, and the opening of the podium was announced.
"Ladies and gentlemen, this is the time that has been set aside for public comments. If you have a public comment this evening and you have not signed up, in a moment, please raise your hand and I will recognize you. When I do, please go to the podium, state your name, and tell us where you are from. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. There's a green light on the podium that will come on when your time begins. A yellow light will come on when you have about 30 seconds left, and a red light will come on when you need to conclude your comments."
3 minutes. Just 3 minutes. So short a time. How could I possibly make them see? I opened the notebook, looked down at it, but the words were a jumble in my mind. At the podium, a man was talking about a change in the regulation of lot sizes in Manio and how it would lead to overdevelopment. From behind the marble counter, the county commissioners watched, polite yet emotionless, giving no hints as to what they were thinking. Would they even hear me? Who was I to talk to them? I'd only been here a few months. The man petitioning the court right now had lived here 27 years, and no one had protected him when a developer bought the land next door and made plans to stack it full of condos and retail shops. Why would anyone care about Iola's story? Movement on the opposite end of the room caught my attention. Someone was threading a path through the crowded side aisle. Slick blonde hair swayed over the shoulders of a tight red dress. "Gina," I whispered. Paul looked up, then turned a wary look my way. Another familiar face towered over the crowd behind her. Ross. "Oh, no," I whispered. If Gina was here, it was a given that she knew about our plan and had come to derail it if she could. I should have known she wouldn't quietly disappear after our confrontation in Iola's house. Anytime shots were fired, Gina made sure she won the war, whether she really cared about the spoils or not. Just the fight was motivation enough.
"Steady now."
Paul winked at me. I focused on the podium again, staring straight ahead as one speaker and then another came and went, airing grievances and concerns having to do with everything from school funding to noise control ordinances. Everyone had problems and needs, and every need seemed important. A building contractor spoke about the cost-effectiveness of having borrow pits nearby to provide fill for construction and sand for waterfront homes. A couple whose life savings were tied up in a beach house that now had runoff sitting underneath it pleaded for new measures in flood control and stormwater retention. My head was spinning by the time Geneva's name was finally called, and she walked calmly to the podium.
I could feel Gina's laser focus from across the room as Geneva talked about the community of Fairhope and the fact that the town and its residents were already struggling to recover from the effects of multiple storms.
And we in Fairhope are no strangers to the experience of living next door to borrow pits. In the past, many of us have lived with trucks rumbling in and out at all hours, and dust and fumes, as well as the noise of drag lines and dredging equipment endlessly removing sand and filled dirt so that it can be used to satisfy the needs of others. But I would like to tell you that in Fairhope, we love our community. We don't want it to be pillaged.
She punctuated with a nod and a pause, and in the room, murmurs of agreement went up. Audience members shifted forward in their seats as Geneva continued.
My mother-in-law is 87 years old. She has lived in Fairhope all her life. Her greatest joy at this advanced age is sitting on her screen porch with her coffee and watching her birds. If the proposed property, the Beignet Estate, is used as has been suggested, she will have a mining operation less than 30 yards from her back door. Our daughter's house is next to hers on property that has been in our family for over 100 years. If these pits go in, trucks and equipment will be rolling past literally feet from where her children play. Now I ask you, close your eyes for a minute, and picture that it's your mother, your daughter, your grandchildren, your house. Fairhope is a community, a place where fishermen have raised their families since before the Civil War. Like every community, it has flaws, but it is our community.
Geneva glanced down at the podium as the warning light went on.
I know my time is almost up, and I know there are others who wish to speak to this issue, so I'm going to stop here and trust that you on the Commissioner's Court will do what is just and fair. If other towns need sand or fill or retention sites for stormwater, let them truck in their filled dirt or find the space in their own communities. We should not, because we are a small community tucked back in the maritime woods, be railroaded by moneyed interests seeking to condemn a historic property. I'd like to request that before any digging can take place in Fairhope, a public hearing be held to discuss a moratorium on borrow pits of any kind until the community can look at zoning changes to prevent such activity in the future.
Cheers erupted around the room as she left the podium and walked down the aisle. Patting my shoulder, she leaned close to me.
Go get 'em, Tiger. You tell them what Iola would think of them dozing her house under and digging a hole in her woods.
The next person I have is Tandy Reese.
The man with the clipboard looked expectantly toward the gallery, and every eye in the room turned my way as I stood. My heart pounded wildly in my chest. The aisle seemed impossibly long, like the distance to Iola's house in my dream, when my legs wouldn't carry me. The room, the voices, the people shifting forward in their chairs, Paul passing the poster boards down the row, the commissioner shuffling papers on the dais, the air conditioner kicking on overhead. Everything seemed far away. As I set the notebook on the podium, opened it, shuffled the pages, there was a strange silence in my mind. Please help me do this, I whispered into it. Please help me be good enough. My name is... My voice cracked and the microphone squealed, getting feedback from somewhere. In the periphery of my vision, Gina scoffed, pushing off the wall and tossing her hair, then slipping her hand over Ross's bicep and whispering something in his ear. The green light on the podium blinked on, and I started again. My name is Tandy Reese. I live in the cottage at Benoit House in Fairhope. The voice seemed to come from outside me, but it was strong and clear. I heard the words as if they were someone else's. I've been caring for the place since the death of Iola Ann Poole, the longtime owner of the property. Gina coughed, and one of the commissioners glanced her way. I straightened my shoulders and went on. For once, I would not let my sister or anyone beat me down. I wasn't that little girl hiding behind the sofa anymore, trying to keep myself hidden to survive. I was a woman ready to finally make her own life. I'm just across the salt meadow and through the woods from Binks's store. The back portion of the Benoit estate is the property in question for the borrow pits, and the historic home under threat of condemnation lies directly west of my cottage. My grandfather was an insurance adjuster who many times assessed storm damage to homes here on the Outer Banks, and my father ran his own construction company for years. I often helped him with his jobs as I was growing up, and I recently completed repairs to water-damaged areas of Sandy Seashell Shop, so I do know a bit about storm damage and structural renovation. Gina sighed loudly, and my thoughts jumped. Taking a breath, I focused on the notebook again. Somewhere on the dais, a pencil scratched against a piece of paper. Who was writing, and what? I closed my eyes, opened them again. Benoit House can be saved. It deserves to be saved. Many of you have heard of the house. It's one of a few original Victorian-style homes remaining on Hatteras. If you know the Outer Banks well, you probably know of it. Before you consider condemning Benoit House, you should understand what you will really be tearing down. That house is a wreck, and she knows it. Gina moved from the wall, stepping toward the podium. She's been trying to keep people out so they won't see that, but I was inside the place just the other day, and there were buckets full of water everywhere. The ceilings are falling in upstairs, and... Sit down, someone yelled from the gallery. The judge hammered his gavel, attempting to bring order to the room.
Ma'am, you have not been recognized by this court.
He pointed the gavel at Gina.
If you would like to speak, you may raise your hand when we ask if there are any more comments. And at that time, you will be recognized by the court. However, if there are any further outbursts, I will ask that you be forcibly removed from the room.
Gina's nostrils flared, and she bolted her arms, sulking against Ross. At the dais, the commissioners leaned away cautiously, now fully sensing what a contentious issue we were dealing with. Where a moment ago they had seemed receptive, now they appeared reserved, careful. I fumbled through my notes, trying to find my place again. How much time had gone by? How much did I have left? A page of information about the current damage to Benoit House and the details of its historic value drifted to the floor. I didn't retrieve it. I'd like to read something to you, I said instead, taking one of Iola's letters from the side pocket of the notebook. This was written by the owner of the house, Iola Ann Poole, who, though it was never widely known, was a blood relation of Gerard Benoit. She was the child of his eldest son and a housekeeper of Creole heritage. Over the course of her life, she not only cared for the members of the Benoit family, but she served this country in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps in World War II. She traveled the world, yet this island was the place closest to her heart. She documented her life in letters that she kept in boxes. They were her prayer boxes, her letters to God. But they should speak to all of us. Closing the notebook, I unfolded the letter. She wrote this just after the famous Ash Wednesday storm lashed the eastern coast for 3 days in 1962. The nor'easter came in without warning on the night of March 7th, and by the time it was over, it had killed 40 people on the eastern seaboard and injured over 1,000. At that time, Iola was struggling to care for her biological grandfather, Gerard Benoit, who was bedridden and stricken with dementia. She had also suffered the recent loss of Isabel, who by blood relation was her aunt, but whom she loved as a sister. Here is what she wrote in the aftermath of that terrible storm. Homes lie toppled in the sea. Power poles lean against wires that hang twisted like thread. Boats sit upended and piled on the shore. The road has been lifted and broken. The storm has cut an inlet through the island between Buxton and Avon, separating the south from the north. It seems as though our lives here will never be whole again. There is too much devastation to face. Yet we of this island slowly come forth from the wreckage. There is no other way for us, Father. Dawn comes after the darkness, and with it the promise that what has been torn by the sea is not lost. All of life is breaking and mending, clipping and stitching, gathering tatters and sewing seams. All of life is quilted from the scraps of what once was and is no more. The places we have been, the memories we have made, the people we have known. That which has been long loved but has grown threadbare over time and can be worn no longer. We keep only pieces, all colors, all shapes, all sizes. All waiting to be stitched into the pattern only you can see. In the quiet after the storm, I hear you whisper, Daughter, do not linger where you are. Take up your needle and your thread and go see to the mending. I stopped reading there, looked at the men and women on the dais, the people with the power to save or condemn Benoit House, the power to finally validate the hidden work of Iola's life. On the podium, the yellow light blinked on. A week after this letter was written, an original Remington bronze worth $900,000 was donated to a relief fund created to help rebuild the island and to close or bridge the new inlet. At the time, residents were so desperate to reunite the north and south ends of the island that they were dumping junk cars in the inlet hoping to close it. The donation of the statue was made anonymously. You can see a newspaper article about it on the poster boards that are being held up in the back of the room. In fact, you can see a number of articles and photos and letters there. They tell the story of this island, but they also tell the story of a woman few people really knew. She devoted herself, her resources, her energy, her efforts, her prayers to the Outer Banks and the people who live here, many of whom were strangers to her. She gave almost everything she had, and when this last storm came, when water began trickling through the roof of the home she had loved most of her life, instead of asking her neighbors to pick up their mending threads and help her save her house, instead, at 91 years old, frail in her body and alone in her home, she put buckets and pots and pans under the drops, and she served her neighbors. The Tiffany Magnolia lamp that caused such a stir, that created the fund to aid families displaced by the recent storms, came from the upstairs bedroom in Benoit House, the last untouched place in the house, the room where Iola Ann Poole died. The red light came on. No one in the chamber moved. On the dais, the commissioners were gazing past me, looking at the posters, finally meeting the small, quiet woman so few people understood. I finished with the last paragraph of what Paul and I had written. By the world's standards, she might not have been a person who really mattered, who was noteworthy. But by all the standards that matter most, she was an incredible human being. She touched the lives of people who never knew her. She asked for nothing in return, no press coverage, no name on a plaque, no TV interviews, no thank you notes. We have the chance to honor her with this one final act of gratitude. We can save her house, the house she intended to leave in the hands of the church so that it would be cared for and used for something good. I hope, I pray, that you who sit on this court and all of you who are in this room today will feel, as I do, that this is a cause worth fighting for. Gathering my papers, I turned to leave. Behind me, members of the gallery were slowly rising to their feet. Near the back door, Gina threaded her way through the crowd, making a hasty exit with Ross in tow. A man, a stranger with the ruddy look of a seaman, began to clap, the noise shattering the silence. Another set of hands joined, and another, the applause slowly growing as Iola's neighbors came out to meet her for the very first time. Chapter 26. Outside, the tips of tree branches squealed as they scratched across the moving van. I walked to the window and looked, then noticed the sun catcher still hanging there in its green ribbon. The knot was just beyond my reach. Guess it's time. Paul walked out of the closet, glancing down at the moving van. Here, I've got it. He stretched toward the ribbon, his body molding against mine, the sleeve of a shirt printed with turkeys and flip-flops and swim trunks tickling my ear. Where in the world do you find these things? I grabbed the fabric, giving it a playful tug. What? He coughed softly in his throat. It's my Thanksgiving shirt. Thanksgiving's not until tomorrow. His lips spread into a playful smile, his brown eyes catching the window light and turning the warm color of polished wood.
I have something better in store for tomorrow.
Your mom will love that. Paul's mother had already assured me, long distance, that she was not in any way responsible for his fashion sense.
My mom's gonna love you,
he said, and I felt myself melting. Never, ever in my life had I imagined that there could be someone like Paul Chastain. The way I felt about him was the stuff of fairy tales. And each day it grew and became more real. The sun catcher came loose unexpectedly, and I caught it as it tumbled toward the Tiffany Magnolia lamp.
Watch the lamp,
Paul squeaked, sucking a breath through his teeth. Me? I giggled, setting the sun catcher on the bare mattress. Isabel's wedding quilt had already been carefully packed in a box, as had almost everything else in the house. The Tiffany Magnolia was waiting for a local antique dealer to come and expertly prepare it for transport. Below on the lawn, a car pulled in, and then another, followed by a Suburban with an antique store logo painted on the side. Right on time, I guess. I touched the sun catcher, thinking of the first day I'd seen it, its colored light drawing me toward Iola's boxes.
Right on time.
Paul echoed. His eyes met mine for a moment. I thought of the night we'd spent traveling together through the prayer boxes, trying to save this house.
Guess we'd better go let them in.
The door's not locked. Besides, the kids are downstairs. I sat on the edge of the bed, took the little hummingbird in my lap, fingered its glass wings. Paul slipped in beside me, stretching an arm around my waist and hugging me close. I rested my head on his shoulder.
It's what has to happen, you know,
he reminded. I know.
You wanted to save this house.
Yeah, I did. The trail of his fingers was feather light on my skin.
You know, some things are pretty much impossible.
I nodded, watched the hummingbird's wings cast color over my fingers. Thought of Iola's belongings, now packed in cardboard cartons all through the house. I just wonder how she would feel about it if she were here. All these people handling her stuff, moving her out. Paul ruffled my hair, then kissed it.
Well, you've pretty much done the impossible here, but the fact is, now that the roof has been redone, the place has to be gutted if it's going to be saved.
I know, I know. Despite all that had happened, despite the fact that this house really belonged to the island, there was still a part of me that didn't want to share it.
And considering that everyone from the mayor to the kids in school have their pennies invested in the renovation fund, it's good that there's a competent handywoman right next door, making sure it's all done the way it should be. This house has another 100 good years in it. Who knows what it'll see?
Well, quite a few weddings and lots of museum traffic. I turned to Paul, wondering again how Iola would feel about so many people tromping through her home. She'd been a private woman, but she and Benoit House had an extraordinary past, a story that should be shared. The attic had been filled with trunks containing photos, ledgers, and other bits of Outer Banks history from the Benoit shipping empire, dating all the way back to the mid-1800s. Some had been ruined by the water leaks, but many had survived, and there was much to be sorted through yet.
Relax.
Paul slipped a finger under my chin and kissed me, then whispered against my lips.
If anyone can make it all happen the way it's supposed to, you can.
There were footsteps downstairs now, and voices. I can't believe all these people came to volunteer, especially right before Thanksgiving.
They love this house, and they love the island.
Standing, he took one last look around the blue room.
Guess we'd better head down there before they start loading things without us.
He crossed the room and grabbed a clipboard from the dresser.
Here's a list of which stuff goes to storage and which stuff goes to Norfolk for renovations and cleaning.
Nodding, I reached for the poster boards that had helped to save Benoit House. I'm going to put these in the cottage for now, I think, and the suncatcher, too. I don't want them to be in the storage unit.
We did work hard on those posters.
Paul hooked a finger over the edge of one of the boards and opened it.
A masterful job, if I do say so myself. A little more island flair would have jazzed them up a bit, though. Something in a Hawaiian print.
I laughed. Paul could always make me laugh. Even today. With you, everything needs a little more island flair. I laid the posters on the bed, and we stood a moment, looking at the photos of the house in its glory days, taking in the bits of copied prayer letters bearing Iola's words and her sketches. A whelk shell here, a lighthouse there. I hadn't looked at them since they'd been displayed at the public hearing. I touched the drawing of the little girl in the porch chair. I wonder who she was. Christina, maybe? Was this Isabel's daughter, who was born sickly and died so young? Paul shook his head.
That's not Christina. That's the Mulberry girl, the one who's mentioned at the end of so many of the later letters. She doesn't show up until the box from 1986, the glass box. The only reason I remember that is because the box was different, being stained glass, and it was the only box out of order. For some reason, it was on the top shelf, at the very end of the line. That spot should have had the newest box, but it didn't.
That's strange. I traced a fingertip along the outline of the girl, then thought about the box and how close I'd come to toppling it on my head when I had tried to reach it with the short ladder and the broom handle.
She came here to visit, and she had to stay outside on the porch because she had mulberry stains on her feet.
Paul offered.
I don't remember the whole story, but I remember that part. To tell you the truth, by then I was skimming, just looking for stuff that would help us at the commissioner's court.
Mulberry stains on her feet. Something was happening in my mind. There was a reaching and straining, a grasping at threads. I closed my eyes, tried to pull them closer. Paul's voice came from outside the rush of thought.
Yeah, I guess nobody told her you can get rid of the stains if you take the berries that aren't ripe yet, the
white berries, and rub them on the stains. I pressed my hands to my mouth. Drew in a breath, heard the words again in my mind. Honey, just take the white berries and rub them on the stains. There's an old mulberry tree right out back. You can go on and pick some. It's all right. A hand patted mine. I pulled away. A snatch of memory was gone as quickly as it came.
Paul, where's the box? The glass box? I grabbed my head, feeling like it might explode. The glass box, where is it? He drew back, frowning.
It's safe. I packed it myself.
His eyes looked for mine, but I couldn't focus.
Tandy, you all right?
The box, Paul. I need to see the glass box. What was there? What was there in the shadows, just beyond what I could pull from memory? It wasn't even a memory, really. Just a scrap. A few words, a voice, a touch of a hand.
Okay, all right, hang on a minute.
Paul shifted the clipboard, flipped the page.
Container B7. It's on the front porch already. I carried those down a while ago. I thought I'd take them in my pickup instead of putting them in the moving van. It seemed like the prayer boxes should get special treatment until we figure out what to do with them, you know.
His fingers cut my elbow.
Tandy, what's going on? You look like you've seen a ghost.
I have, I whispered. I think I have. I spun around and ran for the door, with Paul calling after me. My footsteps echoed through the house as I dashed past the nursery room, down the stairs, past the volunteers who were already bringing in dollies, talking about how to move the furniture, turning over tables so as to carefully remove the heavy bases. The noise, the activity, seemed far away as I bolted onto the porch. Startled, the cat sat up in the weathered rocker where he'd been sleeping. He arched and stretched, yawning and watching me curiously as I searched the containers on the porch, found the one with the right number, tugged the edge of the tape to pull it open.
We're supposed to be putting stuff in, not taking it out.
The UPS driver joked as he passed by, wearing his civilian clothes today. I didn't answer, just threw wads of newsprint out, until, nestled between four decorated shoeboxes, I found it. The tag from Sandy's seashell shop still visible through the stained glass lid. Was this the box Iola had brought for repair when the shop first opened? The one that had helped to inspire so many of Sandy's creations? I was lifting it out when Paul reached the porch.
See, the box is fine. I told you it was.
I moved to the old swing beside the cat's favorite chair, then opened the lid, checked one letter, then another, until I found the one with the drawing of the Mulberry Girl. There on the next page was her story.
The little girl, Father, the one who sits outside while her grandfather walks upstairs, inspecting the damage done by the tree that's fallen into the second-floor balcony. She doesn't seem very happy today, I say to the man as he comes down with his notepad in hand. Outside, the cat is rubbing around the girl's little mulberry-stained feet. I've tried to interest her in some of my beignets, but she would have none of it. I've packed a few in a napkin for her. Maybe they will cheer her on the drive home. There's no need to fret over the mulberry stains. They come clean if you rub them with the white berries, the ones that aren't yet ripe. I told her that. The grandfather sighs, gazing outward in a way that is troubled, yet kind. The stains aren't the problem, I'm afraid, he says. Child's seen too much alive for her age. Been dropped off again by her mama. No telling for how long. It's always hardest the first few days. Children don't understand. They're sure they did something to deserve it. I never thought any daughter of mine would treat her babies like this. He sighs again and looks down at his hands, the weathered hands of a working man. You a praying woman, Mrs. Poole? Why, yes. Yes, I am, I say. I thought so. He pauses as the church bells ring next door, the sound drifting across the field. I'd appreciate it if you'd mention my granddaughters when you're talking to the Almighty. It's hard to know what to do when the parents won't take care of them, but they won't give them up either. He holds away his emotions and swallows hard, then pulls the ticket from his pad. It didn't mean to burden you. I'll get the report into the insurance company so your railing can be fixed. Until then, better stay off that balcony. Certainly. I fold the paper between my fingers, walk to the door with him. It's no burden, I say, and then give the beignets to him as he opens the door to leave. I will keep your granddaughters in my prayers, especially this little one. Do let me know if things change for the better. It's hard for a child to be away from home. Yes, it is. He wipes the moisture around his eye, and then he gathers the girl and is gone. I never thought to ask her name, Father, but you know the little mulberry girl as you know each sparrow of the field. You are the white berry that removes the stain. Be with her, as you have been with me. Your loving daughter, Iola Ann.
That was me, I whispered,
looking from the letter to Paul. I came here with my grandfather when I was 6. I don't even remember it, except someone's hand, someone's voice. Her voice. I didn't go inside because I had stains on my feet from hiding in the mulberry orchard when my mama left us. The memory was all around me now. Scraps of fear and comfort, loneliness and love, darkness and light. The quilt of who I had become. Beside me, Paul frowned, cocked his head, and looked at the letter, an understanding slowly dawning as he studied the little girl in the sketch.
That was you?
It was. Joy filled me, sweet, overwhelming, rushing like a tide. Iola and I were not strangers. She had kept me in her boxes all these years, in her prayer letters. I was the mulberry girl. Paul's hand slipped over mine, our fingers intertwining as we fell silent in the knowledge, in the secret. No words can encompass the miracles of God. None can contain the magnificence of a wave kissing sand, or the perfect spiral of a shell drying translucent in the sun, or the fire of morning rising over endless water, or the beauty of a hummingbird as it hovers just an arm's length away, mysteriously out of season on the day before Thanksgiving. Its wings stroking air, rapid, invisible, powerful, frozen in time for only an instant. And then it flies away, growing smaller and smaller and smaller against the blue of an endless sky, until finally it disappears into heaven. This concludes the reading of The Prayer Box, a novel, by Lisa Wingate. Copyright 2013 by Lisa Wingate. This book was read by Exie Sands. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Tyndale House Publishers, Incorporated, and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.